From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're looking at Michigan's latest COVID-19 numbers. After weeks of slowing infections, there's been a slight uptick.
And we should come to the reality that until we have a vaccine, the way it looks like right now is that it's not going to go away for some time to come, and we're going to have peaks and valleys.
Also, how legal precedent has shaped police use of force and our tolerance of it in the street and in the courts.
It was very rare that you would get a judge that was willing to recognize bad police conduct unless there was some sort of affirmative, definitive proof.
Plus, a look at the new bilingual news service for Latinx readers in Michigan.
We have to remember that traditional journalism has historically been very white and very male. So reporting what the community says might be seen as advocacy, but we're just telling people what the community is saying.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to look at some court decisions that shape the way police work is done in Michigan and whether there are legal roads out of the status quo.
They take the officer's word for that he or she was threatened by certain actions, and where they might be threatened more by the same action in one community versus another.
But first, let's get a beat on where things stand right now in Michigan. To everyone's massive relief, our state has experienced a decrease in COVID infection rates compared with April and May. But the numbers have been inching up a bit over the past few days. We sometimes turn to Dr. Howard Markell for perspective on this moment in epidemiology. He's professor of the history of medicine and director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Howard Markell, fantastic to hear your voice again.
It's nice to hear yours, too.
Your research on epidemics has covered many kinds of catastrophe in global health. We haven't spoken in a while, and I wanted to ask you your take on the global pace of infections and deaths. Right now, Brazil and the U.S. are continuing to lead the pack. What do you observe happening?
Well, to begin, the critical word in all this is novel coronavirus. It is a virus that we have never seen before. It's a newly emerging infectious disease. It has mutated or changed in some ways to become more infectious to other people. And it also has certain people it likes to attack and harm. But what's really incredible to me is that the metaphor of a wave, which I think is a false metaphor to begin with, but was used during the 1918 flu pandemic, doesn't really hold all that much for coronavirus 19. In fact, it's more like a forest fire that's spreading here and there in a very unpredictable manner. I think we've done a great job in Michigan, and I my hat's off to Governor Whitmer, her staff, that the curve has been flattened. But what we have to remember, not just in Michigan, but elsewhere in the United States, is that all that does, all that social distancing does, and as you know, I'm a big proponent of it, It's a first phase because you're hiding from the virus. You're not interacting with the virus. But once we come out of hiding, as we are in many states across the United States, and not wearing face masks or not washing our hands or not social distancing at the grocery store or wherever, we increase our odds of meeting that microbe. It's circulating. It's out there. And so, let's say there's been about 2 million cases in the United States. Let's multiply that times 25. Say there have been 50 million cases of COVID in the United States. That means there's still 300 million people who are susceptible to it. Mm-hmm. So that's why the wave is not a good metaphor. It's just out there, and it's waiting to infect us.
I hope I'm not getting too micro, but I couldn't help but notice the caseload over the weekend. On Sunday, three more people died in Michigan. There were 146 new confirmed cases. Saturday, 255 new confirmed cases and 20 deaths. 211 cases confirmed on Friday. Generally, the new confirmed cases have been hanging out in the low three digits for about a week. Do you see those numbers as significant?
Well, I do because they're larger than what they were, and they're about 14 days out from when the social distancing measures were lifted somewhat. So the incubation period is about 10 to 14 days, and so we should expect more cases as we do less to hide from the virus. We're certainly seeing that elsewhere. And I do worry about places like Wayne County, where there's been incredible health disparities that this pandemic has unveiled our health disparities among minorities and the poor in a way that you cannot ignore it. And so I worry that those numbers will go up. I do.
There are signs that Michigan schools and businesses will try to stay partly open this fall, but our understanding of COVID-19 as a long-haul proposition is growing. What has that kind of long-term change meant to the generations who've gone through similar things? My husband keeps saying he believes our kids will either only interact online in the future or only in person because of their yeah. quarantine experience. What do you see psychologically in prior pandemics?
Well, we've never had anything quite like this or quite this long. So this is really the grandest experiment in quarantine, isolation, and social distancing ever performed. Now, the good news is that it's working, that there's been a couple of studies in Nature and in Science that have demonstrated, you know, hundreds of millions of lives have been preserved because of the social distancing measures. But to not think that they have a psychological effect on all of us in different ways would be folly. Merely staying inside and not interacting with other people has its own set of psychological whammies that it pulls on you. But for the young who didn't get to go to the prom or their graduation ceremony, are there important moments in their lives? People who can't have funerals for their loved ones. These are things that will keep psychologists busy for quite some time. I will say this, my students, long before COVID, prefer to interact on email, typically at 3 a.m, by the way, until I told them to stop. This has been a trend, you know, using email, text, and so on to communicate long before COVID, but I think it will exacerbate it. And I particularly worry as a teacher, you know, University of Michigan President Schlissel has just announced that we will be going to open and have a public health informed semester. I worry about the closeness of students, particularly in resident dormitories, as well as fraternities and sororities. I worry about the risk of kids wanting just to have parties because that's what college kids do. And then they get close and that's a problem. And I also worry about the teaching experience because I've taught in person for years and I've taught online for only a matter of a few months. And it's not bad as a substitute, but it's not the real thing. So that may affect our students for years to come because of the way they were taught, you know, the great lessons that we learn when we're in college.
If a second wave does hit Michigan, or maybe I should say when, do you see leaders, including institution leaders in academia and maybe even the governor, do you think they will have the political capital to shut it all down again?
I sincerely hope so. This will save lives, and we have to do this, and probably we're going to be doing it in waves of on, off for some time to come until we have the ultimate silver bullet, which is a vaccine. And then, by the way, it'll be incumbent upon all of us to do the right thing and get vaccinated so that we develop herd immunity. But that hasn't happened yet, and it may be some time. It's a pretty tough virus to crack. It's an RNA virus, and we're not, you know, it may take us a while to develop a vaccine. But I think we do have to get used to it. And I would not have said this several months ago because I was hoping the warm weather would make it go away. You know, I had my own magical thinking. But I think this is going to be with us for some time, and we should expect periods where the brakes are on and the brakes are off, depending on what the epidemiological situation is in our home state. I think Governor Whitmer's done a terrific job. I think if her opponents will do the right thing by their constituents, political capital will not be the issue. What we need to do is protect Michiganders from getting sick and potentially dying.
You know, speaking of the learning that's going on, Howard, do you feel like you've learned anything in recent weeks about our relative risk from viruses on surfaces versus our risk of airborne COVID?
Well, the surfaces are not nearly as big a risk as we may have worried about. That doesn't mean you shouldn't clean off things, like if you go to the grocery store and make sure the basket's wiped off, or if you're in an elevator, you should use your knuckles or something else to press the buttons. That's the biggest risk are respiratory droplets, and that's why I worry about the numbers going up about 14 days after a lot of the protesting, particularly in memory of George Floyd, mm-hmm. but the other type of protests as well. Going to a political rally during a pandemic is not a good idea.
mm-hmm. There was some self-flagellating in the media and social media right now that Americans have decided the pandemic is over. They're done with it. And that many of us have gone right back to resuming life as we wish it were, rather than what's medically sound. Do you think it's possible for us to keep COVID-19 and public health over our perceived definitions of personal liberty or freedom, or just what we can handle?
Yeah, that's the challenge. I spent all weekend writing about that, and that is the challenge. But here's the truth. It ain't over yet. And anyone who tells you it is, or anyone who revs you up because of individual liberties, is not thinking of your long-term interest and your long-term health. The problem with a disease that is infectious is that it's not just you who gets it. You can communicate and infect others. And some of those people may get really sick and die. So we have to stick together as a community. And we have to remember that in times of contagious crisis, these temporary infringements on our right to get a haircut or go to the grocery store are not as important as the overall health of our community. That's the way you have to think about it. We're all in it. We've got to help each other. We've got to keep these cases down. And we should come to the reality that until we have a vaccine, I sincerely hope I'm wrong. I sincerely hope I'm on your show a month from now or 5 months from now and say, gosh, was I wrong? The way it looks like right now is that it's not going to go away for some time to come, and we're going to have peaks and valleys.
Dr. Howard Markell is director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Howard, you take care of yourself.
You too, April.
After the break, we're going to meet the founders of a new bilingual media service that hopes to fill some of the information gaps in the Latinx community.
There's no Univision, there's no Telemundo, there's nothing really. I mean, I know technology is growing a lot, so a lot of people have more access to the internet, but there's still no open free news source that undocumented or Spanish-speaking folks can have here in Michigan.
That's right around the corner. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Could 2020 be a more critical or challenging time to start up a bilingual nonprofit news source for Michigan? And could Spanish-speaking communities have a greater need? As everyone's coping with the pandemic, the risk of coronavirus in the workplace, a lack of health care, and civil rights issues, there is a serious lack of good breaking news information in Spanish. My guests today are some of the founders of Candor Media, Jose Jimenez and Elizabeth Rogers Triard. Jose, Elizabeth, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Elizabeth, will you tell us the origin story of Candor Media?
I can tell you my part of the origin story. I was at a wedding with our other co-founder, Michelle Jokish Polo, and she talked to me about wanting to have starting a news site for the last year or so. And I said, I've been thinking the exact same thing while we were standing in the appetizer line, and it went from there. You should ask Jose, though, about the beginning, because he and Michelle had already started talking before Michelle and I did.
Right. Jose, some people might know Michelle's name from her role in public radio, actually. Could you tell us how you two started having this conversation?
I knew Michelle just from her reporting. I myself, I'm originally from LA, and I actually wanted to do this since I've moved here. In LA, I read this article from the LA Times about the undocumented family in Flint and how they were, a lot of them were unaware of the lead in their water. And they were finding out from family in LA, they were calling them and say, hey, you have lead in your water. Did you know that? Like, wait, how do you know? Like, well, it's all over the news here.
Because unlike in Los Angeles, there are not a proliferation of Spanish language media services in Michigan, right?
Correct. Actually, I think there's still no open air television stations in Spanish in Michigan. There's no Univision, there's no Telemundo, there's nothing really. I mean, I know technology has grown a lot, so a lot of people have more access to the internet, but there's still no open free news source that undocumented or Spanish-speaking folks have here in Michigan.
So how did this go from just being somebody really should do this to we are the ones who really should do this?
Once Michelle and I started talking about this idea, she was sharing her passion about, you know, movement journalism, about really, you know, giving the community a voice. She introduced me to Liz, and then we just started meeting at coffee shops. You know, we all wanted the same thing. We wanted to provide something to community here and give them a voice.
Yeah. Jose, in your perception, is this just a matter of critical mass? There have actually been a number of journalism startups. I'm thinking of Bridge Magazine, Bridge Detroit. There are podcasts like Daily Detroit that have taken on sort of hyper-regional news in various parts of Michigan. What's going on here that wasn't really being addressed?
I think just from my experience in the brief time, the 3 years I've been here in Michigan, I really saw a lack of representation in local news here in West Michigan. I felt like the community, especially when just specific to like when our work with Cosecha, when we're doing marches, there was always this narrative of how the police kept the march safe, you know, and there wasn't enough emphasis on stories of the community, like why we're even marching, why are we in the streets, why are we making so much noise? And so I really wanted to, you know, use my experience as a filmmaker and a storyteller to, you know, to tell those stories.
You're also a bilingual news outlet. Why was that important?
I mean, that was one of the main reasons I wanted to start this, was just to provide another Spanish outlet. I think today there's not enough. I know here locally in West Michigan, there are a few Spanish-speaking news, and they're very important. But I think they don't really provide an in-depth coverage of local news. They provide a lot of news about, you know, a lot of our community's home countries in Mexico or in Central America. But, you know, there's really lacking this in-depth conversation about local news in Spanish here in Michigan.
One of the things that's really interesting to me about this, that as a bilingual news service, it feels like this is something that might speak to people who, you know, again, just do not get some pretty basic stories covered in the language in which they are most fluent. But also there's a voice available there for maybe whose parents came from another country and who maybe grew up speaking, you know, a lot of English themselves, may not feel totally comfortable with their Spanish, but who still feel very much, you know, a part of Latinx culture. And like, this is who they are. This is how they identify. Is it ever difficult representing both of those readers' kinds of needs in the same service?
I mean, yes. I mean, I think you just summarized my life. You know, I'm a Mexican-American. You know, it's always been a struggle, at least for me personally. You're always trying to satisfy two cultures. The scene from the movie Selena always comes to mind, you know, like we have to like Oprah and we have to like Christina. We're working harder than a lot of other people just to satisfy, you know, our parents, satisfy our country. It's always a lot of extra work. And I think that's okay. And I'm up for the challenge of, you know, being able to give a message in English. And also, like, I've always worked in Spanish television, so I know that it's not about translating message, it's more about transcreating and making sure the same spirit of the message is comes through in both languages.
So, Elizabeth, what are some of the stories that Candor has covered that you could maybe tell us about that have a little bit of a different feel than they would if they were covered in other media?
The main thing, as Jose mentioned, is we're very community-focused and people-focused. As you know, there's tons of news happening right now with the protests and political upheaval in our country. And we're looking to cover what the community is talking about from their point of view. So we have covered the protests, but we've covered the protests by interviewing people. Why are you here? What are you doing? Versus like, hey, this just happened. Or there was two protests. Well, there were multiple protests at the same time the first Saturday that a lot of this was happening. And there was a protest and a rally of about 300 or 400 people at the Calder Plaza that normally would have had coverage, would have had police, would have had news coverage, and nobody was there because everybody else was over at the police station. But this was a local family who had pictures of their son and grandson who had been allegedly beat up by the Grand Rapids police, who were talking about their most recent case and their needs, the Phillips family. And so that's a big deal, and it wouldn't have been covered otherwise, this local issue in the midst of this larger national conversation, if we hadn't been there. Michelle has done opinion pieces with Brandy Arnold, a local person here, about her reaction to the Saturday protests that were different than a lot of people's about what happened downtown. She put up yesterday a story about a woman living in a prison here in Michigan and what it's like to be in prison in a life sentence during COVID and just how hard that is. And those are stories that are important that aren't often covered.
Jose, can you talk a little bit about how fresh the conversation is between this intersection of the rights of immigrants, the rights of Latinx people, and Black Lives Matter?
I mean, I can do my best. I think as a Latino, I see that if the Black Lives Matter movement succeeds, our community succeeds. You know, we think our fate is tied. Both our communities have seen extra attention by the police. Both our communities have been attacked by police. I mean, let's call it what it is. And I think I'm really happy to see just the unity between our two communities now. A big hashtag going around is "Tu lucha es mi lucha," which means that your fight is our fight. And I just really admire the unity that the Latino community is showing with the Black community right now. That really shows that our fight is their fight.
Can I also add that for many in our community, these communities are both of their communities. We have several people in our community who are Afro-Latinx, and so they have to fight injustice as a Black person and as a Latinx person. Sometimes we talk about folks as two separate communities, but there is a lot of people who inhabit both of those identities for whom this is even harder. And we want to make sure that we cover that story as well.
Are there issues within the pandemic that you feel like you've been able to bring some different angles to?
I think that we're definitely working on those stories. I really want to tell stories of just here locally. There's been a fund called La Lucha Fund, which has really come about trying to help our undocumented community members because, you know, they're considered essential, but yet they don't receive any federal funding or any federal help. And so this fund, I really want to do a story on them and just how they've been able to just come together and help the undocumented community here in West Michigan.
Sorry to interrupt, but when we talk about who's working in essential industries, I guess that means a lot of our agricultural industries, chicken ranches, hotel and hospitality, back of the house workers in restaurants. I mean, these are people who don't traditionally have access to traditional health care.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and one example I always give out, Grand Rapids is often known as like Beer City. And beers, you need hops to make beer. But you can't drink a beer without knowing that an immigrant touched, those hops to make that beer. I feel like we really take for granted the work that a lot of our agricultural workers and undocumented workers do for us every day. It's unfair to be considered essential, but also considered illegal at the same time.
If you're just joining us today, my guests are Jose Jimenez and Elizabeth Rogers Duillard. They are on the leadership team for Candor Media, a new bilingual news startup. I wanted to ask you about a project that you have in development that's a documentary film about Lance Corporal Gilmar Ramos Gomez. Can you explain a little bit about who he is and why he was an interesting subject for you?
You know, this documentary really is personal to me because I myself have had history with, having my citizenship in question. But well, to tell you a story about Gilmar Ramos Gomez shortly, you know, he's a Lance Corporal in the Marines. He was arrested for trespassing at a Spectrum hospital. And
he was nearly deported after this arrest, wasn't he?
He was. Actually, a police captain with the Grand Rapids Police Department. When he was off duty, saw Hilmer's mugshot on TV, on the local news, and decided to call his ICE contact and email him, asking him to verify his status. Meanwhile, GRPD has already arrested him and found in his possession his passport his Michigan Real ID, which only citizens can get, and his military dog tags in his possession. Fast forward Friday, ICE interviews him at the Kent County Sheriff's Department, and they issue deportation orders. There's still a lot of questions to the story. The ACLU of Michigan has sued ICE to reveal the interview that they conducted with the Marine, because there's no way that this man should be considered for deportation. He is a citizen. He had his passport on him. The 14th Amendment grants us citizenship to all who are born here, but Latinos always have to prove themselves more. And even when we have the proof, sometimes that doesn't even matter. We're still at risk of being deported. We know that this is not the first time that a citizen has been deported. And we want to really share that this story is just part of the national picture of the immigration problem of America and how it criminalizes people of color, immigrants of color. And we really want to give this story a national context and not just this regional story.
You know, there was a time when getting a journalism project off the ground meant trying to make it to some kind of print edition. I just don't know if that's something that people think seriously about anymore. What are your ambitions for Candor? I mean, would you like to see it become some sort of print publication, or do you think online is the way to go?
Liz and I always joke about this, but like I've had like this vision of a kind of transforming local news. If we analyze the story of Homer Ramos Gomez with the local news, the reporter in that story that the captain from GRPD saw, you know, there wasn't a single mention of him being a Marine. You know, the way it was reported was this man got on the helicopter pad and, what were his intentions? You know, there was this whole narrative of scaring the public and how the police kept it safe. But the reporter did not mention that he had PTSD. The reporter didn't mention that he was a Marine. You know, those little facts there matter. And when it comes, and it is our responsibility as journalists to give all those facts. And I kind of envision hopefully Candor Media growing and becoming like a different source of local news across the country, not just here in Michigan.
You know, Jose, you mentioned that a fair amount of your grounding in this comes from your interest in movement journalism. We're in the place in the country right now where people do tend to seek out digital news, and they tend to seek out digital news from sources that they feel an affiliation with. There's no question that there's a need for more Spanish language media within Michigan. But I do wonder, as Americans tend to view media more generally with a skeptical eye, is a news service that takes advocacy as part of its founding mission, is that something that you think is going to be a durable model over time?
If not just durable, I think it's essential, especially with lack of representation. If we're not doing it, like, who's going to speak for the community? I think back of, like, you know, advocacy newspapers, maybe, I don't even know if they want to call them so, but like, in East LA in the 70s during the Chicano movement, the newspaper called La Raza, you know, it was very much there to help lift the voices of the community there and fill the void of, you know, traditional media not getting our side of the story. You know, a lot of times traditional media is white and male, and they are often the ones that gets to ask the question. So it's really important for us to be at the table to ask those questions that our community is asking. You know, I think traditional media often is too buddy-buddy with power. And I think as journalists, our responsibility is to always question those in power.
I would like to add that it's considered advocacy journalism often because it's different than traditional journalism. But we have to remember that traditional journalism has historically been very white and very male. So reporting what the community says, reporting what the community wants, might be seen as advocacy, but it's also just straight news because we're just telling people what the community is saying. The other thing is we're approaching this from a point of view that certain things do exist, and the role of journalism is to find the truth and not get sucked into the both sides-ism that has become so prevalent in journalism today. So we assume that racism exists. We assume that the large body of work that exists in America about the disparities over racism in the criminal justice system. It's been documented over and over and over and over. we assume that that's true. And so we report from that place of truth, and we report knowing that those power imbalances are in place. It's not going to a protest and quoting the anti-racist activist and then quoting the neo-Nazi counter-protester as if the neo-Nazi has anything important to say. Since hopefully as a culture, we've decided that that is bad. And obviously we haven't, because we're still fighting that fight. But from our newsroom's point of view, racism is wrong. Racism exists. White supremacy is a huge problem in America. And so we're going to report from that truth and from what the community is dealing with in that truth. So that is, I think, considered by a lot of people advocacy. But I think as long as we're chasing the truth will speak for itself.
We've been talking today with Jose Jimenez and Elizabeth Rogers-Triard. They are part of the editorial team for Candor Media, a brand new nonprofit news source for Michigan. Guys, thanks for talking with us about this, and good luck with the venture.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
In just a moment, we'll hear from two Michigan legal experts about the cases that have shaped the way police use force.
You can see in the United States Supreme Court the exact blindness to addressing race.
And what the possibilities for change might look like within and outside those frameworks. That's straight ahead after a short break. Stay tuned. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. From the state's top leaders down to the dinner table, we're all coming to terms with what needs to be done to address the issues brought up in Black Lives Matter protests, from Detroit to Grand Rapids to Howell. We've talked on the show over the past couple of weeks about several pieces of this issue, from police training to community work to education in our state schools. Hidden from a lot of our eyes are the legal engines that can inform the structures of government and law enforcement. We wanted to get a better grasp on that framework and what the courts have said about police use of force. With us today is Tracy Brame, an associate dean at Western Michigan University Cooley Law School, Grand Rapids campus. She's a former public defender in Washington, D.C. and Detroit. Tracy Brame, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Eve Primus is with us as well. She's a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. She teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and writes about structural reform in the justice system. Eve, it's very nice to have you as well.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask you both a little bit about the evidence you've seen that what happens in the United States court system has real influence on police conduct. Tracy, what comes to mind when you think about that question?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we were talking about the Supreme Court earlier, and as we saw with all the cases that the court has taken up, one of the cases they declined to take up was a case involving qualified immunity for government officials. And
just for the layperson's definition, what we mean when we say qualified immunity is that police officers and police departments are immune from, say, damage suits in civil courts when use of force has either a lethal or a very serious consequences for the people that police interact with. The High Court actually declined to hear 8 separate cases involving qualified immunity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And Justice Thomas, who is typically considered to be relatively conservative, dissented from the court's action in those cases. But I'm interested to hear Eve's kind of history of how this kind of intersects with these cases that we see involving excessive force and police brutality, et cetera. But one of the issues with qualified immunity that we've seen come to the forefront is that while it was originally intended to give officials leeway to do their jobs without having to worry about lawsuits, to be able to make split-second decisions, right, without having to think through the legal ramifications of it, what it's become, particularly as interpreted by the courts, et cetera, along the way, is basically a cloak that sometimes covers particularly police officers who are involved in misconduct. And so you might have, you know, cases in which a police officer uses excessive force, someone brings a case to court, and then, you know, we're caught in this catch-22 where the court says, well, you know, yep, you brought this case. I know you are arguing that your civil rights were violated, et cetera. But officer has qualified immunity right? You know, as long as he was doing something, he wasn't doing something that he knew he shouldn't have been.
Right.
Right. As long as that he wasn't violating a right that we have already established as a right.
Yeah.
So since we didn't say chokeholds weren't, were violative of rights, you know, we're going to give him immunity in this case. And it's more complex than that, obviously, but that's just an example of the court's actions making a real difference.
Right.
Because it really is the court, the evolution of qualified immunity has come more through the courts than through the legislature.
Eve Primus, how would you answer this question? What evidence do we have that what happens in the courts has a real trickle-down influence in police conduct?
Well, I think part of the problem is that the Supreme Court has created some very amorphous tests for assessing when police use of force is excessive. So there's a series of cases that they've decided over time that date back to 1985, which was the first one. It was called Tennessee versus Garner. It was a case involving an eighth grade African-American boy who was 15 years old, who broke into a house and stole $10 and a purse from that house. And the police got a call and responded, and the boy was running away from them. And they shot and killed him in order to prevent his escape. And the United States Supreme Court said in Tennessee versus Garner that that was an unconstitutional use of force by the police. But the holding that they issued in that case was actually quite limited. They said, if you have a suspect who threatens an officer with a weapon, or if the officers have probable cause to believe that the suspect has committed a crime that involves the infliction or the threatened infliction of serious physical harm, then the police can use deadly force. And so it left a lot of unanswered questions. They did say that the police should try to give a warning before they use that force, but there was a lot left open, like what kinds of weapons count as weapons that a suspect could have that might justify the use of deadly force, or what kinds of crimes involve the threatened infliction of serious physical harm. I mean, is that just someone who says, like, I could kill you? Is that a serious threat of serious physical harm that would then justify the police shooting a fleeing felon? So that was the first sort of big Supreme Court case. And then 4 years later, they decided a case called Graham versus Connor, which did not involve deadly force, but sort of expanded the lens of the Supreme Court's test for determining when police use of force would be deemed constitutionally unreasonable. Graham was a case in which, again, another African-American man who was a diabetic and needed to get some juice to counteract an insulin reaction went into a convenience store. And he saw there was a line at the cashier, so he left and had a friend drive him home. And there were officers who saw this and deemed the behavior to be suspicious. And so they stopped the car, and Graham was having an insulin reaction and running around the car, and he passes out, but the officer grabs him, throws him on the hood of the car, breaks his foot, cuts his wrist, bruises his forehead, injures his shoulder. And they eventually let him go when they figure out that nothing happened. But he sues and it goes up to the United States Supreme Court. And the court issues what they call the reasonableness test for determining when a police use of force or a police seizure will violate the constitutional restrictions on reasonable uses of force. And so they said, look, like, we're just going to balance like the government's interest here against the nature of the force that was used. And we're going to consider how serious the crime was, whether the suspect posed an immediate threat to the safety of the officers, whether the suspect was resisting. And they put a heavy thumb, I think, on the scale in favor of the officers as part of this test, because they said in the Graham case, we have to take into account that officers are making split-second decisions when they use force as a way of saying we give them a little bit more latitude in this reasonableness balancing. So in the end, this leaves us with a very sort of open-ended standard that the lower courts have to apply. And there are a lot of things missing from that standard. So for example, they never talk about, like, what about the officer's potential culpability? What if the officer escalates the situation or uses pre-seizure conduct that elevates the risk of there being a forceful encounter? Should that be part of the equation? They never talk about a proportionality requirement. I mean, how much force should the officer use in many respects probably should depend on how much force the officer is threatened with. And one would think that's a natural part of this analysis, but it isn't an explicit part of the test. And there's a lot of room for sort of how immediate the nature of the threat to the officers has to be. And so there's a lot left to the lower courts and a thumb in many respects on the scale in favor of the officers as part of the legal test.
Tracy, how do we get from these ideas about reasonableness and the need to consider, you know, split-second decision-making that happens in the field to situations in which officers might, you know, in the case of George Floyd, might kneel on a man's neck for 8 minutes, killing him? Are there things that the court has not taken into account about other structural problems within the justice system?
So the intersection between what Eve was talking about with respect to the balance of the scale being on the side of the officer, right? The intersection between that and race often leads us to situations like George Floyd. So if we're going to apply a reasonableness test, if we're going to generally kind of cloak officers in immunity and give them basically the benefit of the doubt in these situations, then that leaves a lot of room for bias, conscious and unbiased, the right to play a role in these types of situations. So, for example, of course, we want officers to be able to respond if they feel threatened. But as Eve said, right, they should certainly respond at least proportionately to the threat that is posed. They should be responding, you know, not in a way where a lethal encounter is inevitable. But even that question of when and why officers might feel threatened might have a societal or racial aspect to it or cultural aspect to it that the courts often don't consider in these reasonableness right tests. They take the officer's word for that he or she was threatened by certain actions and where they might be threatened more by the same action in one community versus another. And how you capture that when you're defining these terms and, you know, and when you're setting these standards for force, you know, I guess we could certainly discuss, but those are some of the dynamics that come into play when you don't talk about, okay, what's the officer's culpability in this? You know, I mean, was it reasonable for the officer to be, you know, threatened by this action, et cetera? So, you know, we saw this play out in Georgia just a few days ago mm-hmm. when a young man was shot and killed at the Wendy's, right? And obviously there was a scuffle there. And then the young man had fled and turned around and pointed a taser. And so, you know, again, the question is not, you know, was a young man resisting or even did the officer feel as though, you know, he was in a combative situation or at least a tenuous situation, but was his action necessary under the circumstances?
Right.
And those are the questions that where we need to ask, what role does race and societal, you know, and unconscious bias play in encounters like that?
Eve, did you have something to add there?
Yeah, you can see in the United States Supreme Court, the exact blindness to addressing race that Tracy is talking about. I mean, if you just look at the Graham case, so there was an African-American boy who goes into a store, sees a long line and leaves. And the officer thinks there's some sort of suspicious behavior going on there. Why? I mean, if a white person were to walk into a store and see a line and leave, my sense is there probably would not be the same level of suspicion aroused in that officer, that there was implicit bias going on in that case, but it wasn't a main part of the decision. Now, that was back in 1989. And I do think, though we haven't seen the Supreme Court addressing this in a majority opinion sort of head on, we have seen some lower courts that are willing to take into account implicit bias in related conducts, which gives me some hope for ways in which they could do it here. So, for example, the High State Court in Massachusetts, in a case called Commonwealth versus Warren, held that when a Black man flees from the police in Boston, that is not necessarily a grounds for reasonable suspicion, given the treatment of the African-American population by the Boston Police Department. And so they said, when flight by an African-American is part of what the police are trying to use to justify their behavior, we're going to discount that somewhat, given the history of the relationship. We saw a similar ruling out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals with respect to the Seattle Police Department when it comes to flight, that they have said because there was a DOJ investigation of the Seattle Police Department and there was a pattern and practice of racial profiling found, that maybe when a Black man flees from the police there, it is not indicative of the guilt of that individual. It might be a reasonable fear based on past relationships that individual's community has had with police. So if we translated that over to the use of force context, we could think about whether we should look at the officer's conduct through a lens that incorporates knowledge that we all have implicit biases and that they are often triggered in high stress environments like the ones that the police are acting in.
That's absolutely right. And hopefully more and more courts will acknowledge that, because that's the next step in kind of treating this problem, is the actual acknowledgement that it is a problem. But we then have to hope that not only happens in a reactionary way once we get to court after someone has been, you know, assaulted or killed or what have you, but also that it starts to change the culture of law enforcement. And part of that is recognition by the courts that this is an issue. And hopefully that then trickles down to the way the officers are trained and the relationship between police officers in general and minority communities.
You both have experience working in state criminal courts. Did you see evidence that judges were taking police conduct into account in how they handled people's cases, you know, either in terms of thinking how appeals might play out or just in what they were inclined to believe of what law enforcement told them?
I would say in my experience as a public defender, I worked at both the trial and the appellate levels. It was very rare that you would get a judge that was willing to recognize bad police conduct unless there was some sort of affirmative, definitive proof via like a videotape or a audio tape that would demonstrate that the officer had behaved in a way that involved excessive force or brutality. Because I think the knee-jerk reaction of a lot of the judges is, you're always going to claim excessive force, and I'm scared of the slippery slope if I start to think about what the police conduct looks like and what the lines should be. And they don't know where to draw those lines. So my experience was, unless there was sort of smoking gun evidence, I didn't have judges who were very receptive to arguments about police misconduct or use of force.
So, and the bulk of my practice, I was an appellate attorney. I worked for the Appellate Defender's Office in Michigan and then for the DC Public Defender. And I don't remember very often, if ever, and Eve's experience may be more recent than mine, having police misconduct or the actions of the police play a big role in my cases. I mean, I've had cases overturned because of judicial misconduct during the case, but there seems to be this notion that, again, the police officers are given the benefit of the doubt and that the defendant has found him or herself there through their own actions, right? And then we can kind of start with how they were treated in the court system. But very rarely did we kind of look behind that to say, how did they get there in the first place and what happened during that investigation and arrest?
Mm-hmm. And what you'll see actually in criminal courts is that a lot of times when you have a suspect who has been injured by the police, that there's almost always some sort of resisting arrest charge that the officer will put onto the suspect in that case. And there will be testimony by the officer about how the officer was threatened in some way, or there was some perceived use of force that necessitated the officer to respond using the amount of force that resulted in the injury. And these tend to be rather sort of like what the officer said versus what the suspect says, unless you have documentary evidence. And whenever you have a swearing contest between someone accused of a crime and an officer with a badge, the court often tends to credit the officer with the badge. So that's why I think the social media capturing of what officers have been doing is part of like a vitally important educational effort to demonstrate what's going on and to sort of aid suspects in the credibility battle that they had been losing in the courts up until that point, even though the conduct was probably the same.
I absolutely agree with that. I think that social media and the use of video and that kind of thing has been crucial, because the place where we found ourselves is that we are educating young Black men about how to interact with the police, as opposed to educating officers about their conduct, right? We're telling our sons, make sure if you get stopped, you got to do this, and make sure you know, comply, and make sure you don't do anything that might be considered resistant, et cetera. You know, and obviously we as citizens should be good citizens, but we're going over and above to teach our sons not to provoke police officers, as opposed to kind of putting some of that onus on the police officers, on the police departments, or on law enforcement to make sure that their officers are educated about a broad range of things, about the appropriate use of force, about unconscious bias, et cetera.
Tracy Braim is an associate dean at Western Michigan University's Cooley Law School, Grand Rapids campus. We've also been talking today with Eve Primus, professor of law at University of Michigan Law School. Ladies, thank you so much both for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and April Van Buren. We get help from our crack team of interns, Leah Baldori, Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baird. We really appreciate that you're out there listening. See you tomorrow.